Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is 9/02/2002. This session is an evening forum. The title is Crazy or Blessed, an interface between emotional grief and therapy. This can be found in the library or if you wish to order under FO 2002-36. Let's listen in.
I work here as co-director. We did have some discussion among us tonight whether or not we should go ahead with this forum, given the power of the Vespers service that we just came from. But we felt that we would go ahead partially to provide some opportunity for conversation in a related area in terms of the viewpoint making all the difference. There have been many people that have wondered if Doug left to be on a vision quest of some kind and in search of a deep and powerful spiritual experience. There are certainly others that worry for his safety in that he had Parkinson's disease and was debilitated in some ways, both because of alcoholism as well as because of Parkinson's. And could that have impaired his judgment or not? The topic tonight is, if you saw it out there, said crazy or blessed, the interface between emotional breakdown and spiritual breakthrough. Just to remind everyone that as we think about that, and my guess is, as people have asked me about this over the course of the day, that probably there are as many interpretations of what this topic is meaning as there are people in the room. But my guess is that among us, we probably all have some experience of confusion, perhaps with somebody that we love, somebody that we worked with, where there was a difference of opinion or interpretation about whether or not God was speaking in a new way to someone or whether they were having some problems that they needed to go to a therapist about. There are many who feel these interface in ways that need more respect. And so the group of people, we happen to be extraordinarily blessed this week. There's probably more people in the village this week on our teaching staff with backgrounds in psychology and in spiritual direction. Michael Horn, if you haven't been to his session yet, is a psychiatrist from Seattle. We don't talk as funny as he does in Seattle, however. he originally came from Australia and now is practicing in Seattle as well as teaching on faculty at the University of Washington Medical School and Psychiatry Department. We have over here Nancy Reeves, who is a clinical psychologist and spiritual director, so a bit of a foot in each world as a practicing psychotherapist and as an author. And then on my left is Gary Graf-Wallner, who is a Lutheran pastor, has just been serving a congregation in Bellingham, Washington, and for quite a long time has been trained and is an experienced spiritual director, who we have called to be spiritual director in the village during these few weeks right now. And he has been here and has been assisting us as we have been going through this process of reflecting on the search process. As you should know that since the job of all three of these people starts with good listening, that instead our usual pattern in a forum is that there's a 2 or 3 minute comment by the presenters and then there's a time for questions. Well, they got together at dinner and thought, no, we need to start with people sharing your, when you read this, if it grabbed you in some way, is it out of some personal experience or question or concern about this particular topic? So rather than them starting with even just a few minutes of presentation, we decided that we would start not with a discussion, but with an opportunity for everyone who wishes to simply share how this topic struck you. If you have a question or an experience or a concern in this area, to sort of begin where you all are, and then the panelists will have a conversation with you and with each other about the kinds of topics and themes that come up from that. And then we'll bounce it back again for any other kinds of questions or dialogue.
Would you mind reading once again the title of the topic? Because it caught me on the board.
Crazy or Blessed.
Okay.
The interface between emotional breakdowns and spiritual breakthrough.
Gotcha.
And I'll have to admit to being the one that came up with those words. I could give you a million examples, but one of the most strongest memories that I have was of a friend in graduate school at the Graduate Theological Union who, before he was going to take his comprehensive orals for his PhD, began to act in very bizarre ways. His belief was that he was having ecstatic experiences of the divine. Others were worried that he was never going to get through those comprehensive exams because of his suddenly very poetic behavior compared to somebody who's running a PhD, a dissertation. So, in trying to sort that out with a close friend was very, very difficult. So that would be one example, but my guess is that there are many in this room that I know. Jess, would you mind? So if there isn't any other clarification, let's start with some ideas.
It dawned on me when I was listening here. I was in the Jesuits for 17 years, and I had 13 years of university plus a year of studies in Africa. And I had a master's in theology, and then I left. And I married, and I taught religion. And as I was going through this, I began to drink. And my wife left me because of my drinking, my kids. And finally, I got so drunk one night, living by myself, and I called up a student, and then the student told the principal. Divorce couldn't get me into alcohol treatment, but the principal came and said, you're going to treatment. So when I went to treatment, I thought, I got all this theology, but now somehow something's got to speak to me, and I love scripture. What's going to speak to me? And I thought, 2 Isaiah, Isaiah 40-55, was written when the Jews were in exile. And it begins, comfort, give comfort to my people. You know, tell them that their servitude is at an end. And every time I saw servitude, I saw alcoholism. And for 3 weeks, I divided the time for treatment was 3 weeks, and I divided those 15 chapters into sections and read it every day and prayed over it. And I think I had a lot of head knowledge and I had all kinds of stuff, but I think really going into treatment, facing my weakness, finally hitting bottom and admitting I was powerless was the beginning of a whole new spirituality. And I came back, and when I taught the Beatitudes to kids, I'd have them grade themselves on the Beatitudes, and then I would say, I grade myself highest on blessed are the poor in spirit. I said, And the reason I read it, and then I tell them about alcoholism, and I tell them the New English Bible, and before it was finalized, and one of its preliminary versions translated that, blessed are those who know their need for God. And believe me, when you hit bottom, and you admit you have a problem, and then you have to turn to a higher power, and it's, and that's kind of changed my whole spirituality. And so in a sense, that's crisis breakthrough.
Thanks.
I was attracted to the form by the word crazy. Crazy or blessed. I've been through the William Glasser Institute, all between, I don't know if you're familiar with William Glasser or not, but the idea of crazy, it's an interesting term. There are people that think that mental illness, that there's a myth of mental illness, that to a certain degree it's a choice, and that it's an interesting kind of dynamic, especially if we look at crazy as a reason for behavior when it's a label. And years ago, a man named Thomas Satz wrote an article, The Myth of Mental Illness, in which it's a strategy for people to cope with something that's not going very well for them. And so I'm interested in that aspect of this.
Are you asking a question?
Well, I guess that I would... I guess I would be interested in how people view, how the panel views the word crazy or mental illness as a cause of behavior. Whether you buy that concept that mental illness causes people to do things, or is it the chicken or the egg, the fact that they do things causes the label to be laid on people. And then how you see in working with people that are labeled mentally ill, whether it's possible to cut through it faster by, and this would be an interesting thing, I'd be interested in your concept about this, because of psychoanalysis, I know that you work through a lot of stuff and the language and so on and so forth, but that was then, this is now. The Glasser theory is, that was then, this is now. It's too bad what happened to you. You have to live now. Mm-hmm. What can you do now? How's your life going now? What can you do now to make it better? Mm-hmm. And not spend a whole lot of time going over and over the things that have happened to you. Spend a little time with it, but now talk about, okay, what can you do now? What do you want? What are you doing? Is it working? Not? Let's make a plan. Let's move on with it. Something faster than the long drawing out. And so I guess I'm just interested in any of your ideas about that.
Let's gather a few more thoughts from everyone.
I'm thinking that you guys are, that you might have been talking about the type of a situation where someone suddenly decides to do something that is totally out of their realm, such as take in homeless people or totally change their job or quit their job because they feel that God is leading them that way. And, you know, is that a valid thing? And how do you know when that is happening to you?
I wonder if things struck me at that I heard you reread it was that words about spiritual breakthrough. As I've dealt with a lot of people in our Native community and the struggles that we as Native people have gone through, not only in history, but in this now day and age of dealing with the struggles that they have, of those that came up last week. Spiritual breakthrough for me was being able to come full circle of not only the loss of my Native identity through the assimilation era, but coming full circle and being able to reconnect myself with my Native identity and have in my faith journey have the ideas of the Christianity in their different denominations and the intricate work of my Native spirituality has made my work of being able to, as an individual, become more whole.
Thank you for sharing that, bringing it together for us in the service. Why don't we, I have a feeling that there probably are other experiences particularly that bring people to this topic. But why don't we go ahead and have some sharing by three of you around your thoughts, and then we'll bounce it back out to everyone given the ideas that were shared. Mike, are you willing to be first one?
Sure. I was hearing a lot of different sort of definitions or ways of conceptualizing crazy, because it's a word that a lot of sort of covers a lot of ground, say that. And what we were thinking about, you know, you've brought up all sorts of things we weren't thinking about, which is challenging.
Thanks!
We were thinking about perhaps a more everyday type of crazy. And we were thinking more about breakdown and how one thinks about oneself, and one's life, of course, derives from that concept of oneself. And what a problem, really, the self-concept is. That was part of what I was talking about this morning, and how that sort of defines us and fits us into a box and limits all the possibilities of other things. And one of the concepts of God that sort of interests me, that I'm going to talk about again tomorrow too, is the concept of the absolute other or the radical other. And so once you've defined yourself in a certain way, the ego says, I am this and I am that, then this whole otherness is left out. I was thinking about Doug tonight and Doug's life, and almost everything about Doug was other to what we would conventionally want to define ourselves as. Now, he's a Native American, and that's pretty other for the white population. And then he was abused as a child, something that we don't want to look at either. Then he got sent to Vietnam, and that's something we've totally forgotten just about. And then he's homeless. And my office is on Pioneer Square, so every morning there's the homeless people are walking around. So really we were looking at sort of the problem of sort of defining ourselves in a tight way, and how God can't enter really as another voice when that tightness is there. So, but you've opened up all sorts of other things and other very interesting things. Just the whole way of defining crazy as a is really a limiting thing. And the whole idea of mental illness is a, you know, just a bag full of worms, really. And we try to sort of put it in a box and call it mental illness. And Thomas Sasse blew everything to pieces, really, 20 years ago, and he published this myth of mental illness. I'm actually going to a conference in October, and he's going to be one of the keynote speakers, so I think he's being resurrected. We could go on and on and on. And, but that was what we were thinking about, that more normal sort of breakdown, which we could all, some of the young people, I think, are having that sort of a breakdown right now with the experience of Doug's disappearance. I could see that. And probably some of us, too, in different ways as well. So anyway.
Well, I was just, some thoughts were coming into my mind as everybody was talking, so I want to throw those out. They're not really kind of, I don't know if they're going in a particular direction, but I would have loved to have had Mother Teresa in psychotherapy for a few sessions. I think, you know, when we look at her spirituality, I mean, she was just living her relationship with God, every atom. And she was always going way past her boundaries and getting sick and scaring the whole world by having to take time off and being at death's door and then coming slowly back. And it, you know, it's so possible for somebody to be very balanced and healthy spiritually and, you know, be falling apart psychologically and the other way around. And so often we just make the assumption that if somebody seems to have some wisdom in one area of their life, they've got to have it in all. And I think that really does them a disservice, because I bet you there were few people who would say to Mother Teresa, you know, what you're doing isn't just impacting on you, it's hurting a lot of people. Like, you need to take some responsibility and you need to set some limits. No! I've got to say that, because of her being such a spiritual giant. And yet, you know, the reality was that she did herself and a lot of others a disservice by not setting those boundaries of health. So I think, you know, something, you know, talk about assumptions, we can kind of move past assumptions and move past labeling and just look at what the fruits, I mean, we keep hearing Paul talking about the fruits of our actions and therefore looking at our spirituality and our psychology that way. Is anybody familiar with Dabrowski, Polish psychologist? He has a theory of development that is called the theory of positive disintegration. And he says that when we learn some new information about ourselves or our world, whether that's on a spiritual level or an emotional level or mental or physical, we don't just assimilate it, like Piaget talked about. We usually destroy what's come before. We move to a new level of moral development, and we don't just say, you know, okay, it's okay to steal if you don't get caught. Now I'll move to a higher level and I'll say, well, I guess it's not okay to steal if you don't get caught, except that in some places the problem, you know, we usually work it through so that we let go of the earlier belief. We allow transformation around it. And I find his theory really interesting, that it really fits into Christianity around that kind of, we don't just see destruction as bad, but we see a transformation and a resurrection coming from that. So he's hard to read. You have to really read translations. He only wrote in Polish, and it's a little complex, even in translations. But that whole, he talks about the normal neurotic, you know, and he'll say, in fact, if somebody doesn't go through crises in their psychological development, there's something really wrong. Like, you need to to get to a place of living the old clothes and having them pinch and be too tight, and then finally say, I can't live this way anymore, I've got to change.
I was just thinking about how, in my work, sometimes when people have what I'd like to call a special experience of the divine, it's hard for them to share that. They're embarrassed about sharing that. They think, they wonder if it's genuine. And also when their world is unraveling, they're embarrassed about that, and their heart, it's hard for them to share that. And so for me, part of where these two intersect is who can I be vulnerable with, whether it's a professional person I go to see, or a friend, or a faith community, whether that's a an AA group or a Bible study or a group of men or a group of women. Because I think those can be a resource for someone that's had an experience of the divine that lots of people don't talk about, that makes them doubt whether it's genuine. And those can also be a resource for people who feel like, you know, I've always been in control. I've always had things figured out. And it's like my life is just sort of leaking out of me, and I'm terrified. So to have a friend, a spiritual friend, a community, a resource, a group, to share that in trust and confidence and respect, and not necessarily try and fix it. But receive it and then walk with them and remind people that God walks with us in our brokenness as well as on the mountaintops is for me important.
Mm-hmm. I was just really taken with the comments on assimilation, because that's a very typical conventional psychological approach that we assimilate and accommodate. Now we take in new things and then we accommodate and we sort of build. But Jungian psychoanalysis, which I'm a partaker of, I guess, something like that. Jung's real big break with Freud was around the idea of breakdown, and that he saw the neurosis as a neurotic symptom as an inhibition of a breakdown. The breakdown hadn't actually occurred. Jungian psychology aims at actually facilitating that breakdown in a contained situation, of course. And that actually breakdown is essential because God is, is not really assimilable. God's just a constant challenge. And I brought up today how I think Easter's such a wonderful, we can't really say festival, but a wonderful event that Christians are lucky to have. And the key day of Easter is Easter Saturday, where Jesus is gone completely and there's just nothing, and there's this uncertainty and this wondering of where is God and how is God going to come in. And the experience of being in a Jungian form of psychoanalysis, or now really in contemporary psychoanalysis, because many of the theories are now bringing in the spiritual portion, is that it's a very dark and a difficult and challenging and not really assimilable until everything gets reorganized again. So I think this is what we were getting at, that it's not really something you can just build your muscles with. It's like reaching rock bottom, like you were talking about. And I don't know if you know this, but Jung was one of the advisors of Bill.
Really?
Yes. They used to correspond backwards and forwards.
Oh my God.
And it's very compatible with the Jungian approach. You know, you have to hit rock bottom, you have to break down, and then you can return to a higher power. Mm-hmm. So it's rather we thought it was a bit of a scary title that we thought it was worthwhile addressing or bringing up. And it's just so different from the way we conventionally think about human development, and yet it's sort of inbuilt into the Christian viewpoint.
And there's that experience that's called the dark night of the soul, or you know, going through the desert or the wilderness, where you feel for some time in your spiritual journey that God isn't there, mm-hmm. God's left, and that terrifying experience of aloneness. And many people, John of the Cross and others, have written on that time. And why does it happen? Sometimes you never know. Sometimes people have a sense of what's going on. But many people who have experienced it and allowed themselves to experience it and continued, even though they don't feel God's presence, that their prayer seems arid, dry, they continue their spiritual practices, they'll find at some point that their relationship with God is deeper. It often moves them to a different type of prayer or a different level of their faith, and then they feel God's presence again. There's the fellow, was it Mark, who was talking about Doug's life, mentioned that he had had post-traumatic stress disorder. And I wanted to just talk about that briefly, because it's kind of the fad disorder of the times. Seems that no matter anything bad that happens to somebody, they'll come and they'll say, well, I've got post-traumatic stress disorder. So, because some people go to spiritual directors and other folks having had the experience of PTSD because they think it's that dark night of the soul. And post-traumatic stress disorder is a disorder that can happen to anyone after a traumatic experience, something that is really seen as out of the ordinary. If you react in a traumatic way to a loss that would not be seen as traumatic, then it would be called something else. But PTSD, everybody would look at whatever happened to you and say, oh, that's terrible, that's horrendous. PTSD is a terrible disorder. Somebody has re-experiences the trauma in one of a number of ways. They might have terrifying dreams. They might have flashbacks where they're actually reliving the experience. They don't know they're here, they're back with it. They may have things that trigger them easily. Something that will remind them of the trauma, and so if they're driving a car or if they see a man at night or something, it will cause a strong anxiety reaction. So there are a number of re-traumatizations of the experience. And then as an attempt to try to deal with this, because to feel terrified numerous times a day is exhausting, a person tries to numb themselves to the reality, and they'll withdraw from others, they'll withdraw from the self, they may become depressed, they try to avoid anything they associate with the trauma. And the third category of symptoms is arousal. We don't sleep well. Falling asleep is really difficult, because falling asleep means surrendering to sleep, letting go of control. That's so scary. Or having all sorts of disturbing dreams or nightmares, or just other types of hyperarousal, hypervigilance, like watching for danger all the time, or startling easily, poor concentration, things like that. I have folks come to me, I see a lot of people with post-traumatic stress disorder, and some folks will come to me who have been to a spiritual advisor, director, counselor, and been doubly traumatized, because the person just hasn't realized that this is a psychological disorder, and they've tried to deal with it in a spiritual way. The person feeling disconnected from everyone includes God. And so they may go to the spiritual advisor and say, I feel disconnected from God. And it's happened since I've had this terrible accident, or since I've been raped, or whatever. Well, let's help you with your relationship with God. That's not possible. Well, a person's still traumatized. They need to be desensitized, and there's a number of different psychological techniques that will desensitize them. In my therapy, I look at the meaning of a situation for someone and help them work through the meaning, but not with PTSD. The symptoms are there as a reaction to the trauma, and I desensitize them to that, and then they find that their relationship with God is back on track. Their relationship with themselves and others is back on track. So it's not, we're not looking for some deep, dark psychological reason here. Also, people can get doubly traumatized by going to a psychotherapist who doesn't know how to work with the disorder. Because I've had people who've been in psychotherapy for 2 years looking at what their mother could possibly have done that would have set them up for this, where really it was just the accident. So,
Nancy, I think I'm going to be the devil's advocate on this a little
bit,
because when I was clinical director at Lutheran Social Services, one of the criticisms that we would occasionally get by having professional staff was the fear that psychology had no room for God's presence in the changes that were going on, and that their own belief that God was working, and they were trying to understand that, would be either ridiculed or not respected by somebody who had professional training. And I bet every one of you got an answer to that, but does this ring a bell for any of you in terms of that sense that somehow psychology is dangerous to faith?
Mm-hmm. 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 I was just when I was hearing you a minute ago, Nancy, was a number of times because I've been dealing with grief for several years now, and when I look for different directions of going through the grief and when you're talking earlier this evening about stages and kind of stages, and one of the things that I found just this evening when you were speaking was many times, because I looked for my avenues of way of dealing with my losses, was that sometimes even your friends are people that you feel you trust say basically the wrong words and make it worse. Mm-hmm. And it's a matter of those people understanding how to deal with your friendship with loss that has happened in your life.
With their advice or suggestions or judgment or whatever.
Yes, they would, I don't know if you were mentioning it this afternoon, was that when you were talking about timeline, I follow that up with cultural differences too, and in our native community, our grief is, in our traditional way, is the grieving for 1 year for our person that has lost in our family. And that grief in our spiritual tradition is that we feel that the person that has gone and is going on into the next world is, it takes a 1 year period in our native spirituality to go to the next world. And our grieving process is a year period of grieving. And hearing somebody stand there and say, get on with your life kind of thing, or, can't you let go of him, or can't you let go of her, or something like that.
A couple things running through my mind. One is, some of the historic saints of the church who were mystics could really be a great psychological or psychiatric case study, given, you know, how, what their experience was of the divine or themselves, and yet there are jewels that come from those people that have been a window to the world of the spirit and the other side, however you want to define it. So that's one piece. Maybe there can be a blessing in that sort of mental, emotional, physical disorientation. The other is, in my own experience, in one of the parishes I served, there was a man who had his first schizophrenic break in seminary. And so ultimately he had to drop out of seminary. The church told him that, you know, he couldn't have this particular condition and function as a pastor. And he's never forgiven the church, and so he's had sort of a hate-love relationship with the church and with clergy. And he visits different congregations, and he was active in ours, and sometimes he would, when he was more agitated or if he wasn't taking his meds, he would stand up in a sermon and engage whoever was preaching. Mm-hmm. And he really felt, you know, touched by God that, you know, this person was not speaking for God, was not speaking the truth as he perceived it. Sometimes he'd do this in a Bible study, and everyone would wonder where it was going, whether he was going to pull a gun or hurt someone. And he was brilliant. Well, he is a brilliant person. And sometimes when he'd pray these eloquent prayers that, I mean, you'd think, oh, I wish we could have taped that. Or, I mean, they were just absolutely crafted and from the heart and profound in terms of, you know, sort of like Iona, where they say the air is thin between heaven and earth. Well, when you're in Jim's presence, sometimes the air would be thin. You know, and he would take you over and he would bring you back. But one of the things that was helpful for me in working with him and his psychiatrist, his psychiatrist said to me, he needs to know what's real. And what he may perceive as real may not be reality. And if you just listen to him, you feed into his delusion. If you're a family member, or a parishioner, etc. So when Jim would come to me, and as our relationship grew in trust, one day he said, you know, I have this sense there's going to be this incredible snowstorm on July 23rd. And he was serious, you know. And he said, I really feel that I want to tell my friends, and I want you to, you know, put up provisions because it's going to shut down the freeways and the community. And then he caught himself, and he said, do you think this is in my mind? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Isn't that nice? Mm-hmm. Do you think this is in my mind, or do you think it could really happen? And my response was, time will tell. Time will tell, you know. The odds are probably we're not going to have a blizzard on August or on July 23rd. And he said, well, thanks. I go back and forth. I go back and forth. So for me, it's been helpful, even if it seems awkward at times, to say to someone who thinks they're having a God experience, for whom I think something else is going on, to say, you know, that's not quite the way I see it. Mm-hmm. And then I wait to see if they want to ask me for more, and if they don't, then they go off. So.
Well, I don't know what to say. There's about 15 different topics going. Look what you did. This is a huge topic. topic, psychosis and spiritual revelation, and a psychotic people closer to God in some way. And then sort of also the topic of symbolism's coming up here, like the snowstorm may be a symbolic expression of something that's going to occur on the 23rd of July. So mm-hmm. I don't know what else to say then. But then on the what Nancy said about the ego in PTSD, really if you want to think about PTSD, we're always in a certain amount of PTSD, because one of the essential sort of premises of contemporary psychoanalysis is that we're always losing something. We're constantly in states of loss. If we're not actually in a state of loss, we're actually not responding to the exigencies of existence. Just the very fact that we're aging, we're always in a state of loss, constantly. So really life is a constant series of little and big mournings, and PTSD is a massive loss. It's a loss of one's sense of omnipotence and control. All sorts of other things, of course, on an individual basis. Mm-hmm. So PTSD is a form of mourning which can't actually proceed, because the trauma can't be assimilated and made meaning of. So it's constantly pushing at you to try and make meaning and trying to work it through. So that's just one comment on that. And then the comment about the God and the ego. The ego is essential, like a psychotic person. One way of looking at it, really, are they having experiences, some sort of divine experiences in a highly symbolic sense, but it can't be interpreted by the ego, so it's really of no use to the total personality. So how Jungian thinks about this is that we have an ego-God axis, and the ego is a very important partner. So if the ego is falling to pieces, it's completely dysfunctional and has no sense of reality. And of course, no meaningful experience of the God as the other can emerge. So it's a delicate balancing act to try to, what we call, contain the ego. And one way I think about God is that God has two functions. God is the radically other that bursts in and tries to deconstruct and break the ego down. And then God is also the nurturing, containing part around the ego. It's very important to be able to have these two aspects if one is going to be working in a spiritual and psychological way, just responding to your original question about psychology and spirituality somehow conflicting. One has to be the psychologist who has the containment of the ego, and of course assisting in a spiritual way with that, but also be able to allow for the entrance of the radical other, the way we think about God. So it's a very complicated business, really, very difficult, and yet very important to begin to think about and sort of understand in a more complicated way. So maybe there's about 10 more questions. That's just a big run through.
I am absolutely convinced that good spirituality is good psychology.
Right.
And the best psychotherapist I know is Jesus. So, you know, I try it. I can't see just staying on one side of those or the other.
Yeah, you know, the best psychotherapist for me was someone who I could be vulnerable with. Right. I mean, I just, I think I wrote down, who can I be vulnerable with? And right. For me, I the greatest growth I ever had in going to a psychotherapist was someone who was so, he was that wonderful mix of, I felt I could be totally safe with him because of his struggle. He was a brilliant man in some ways and so able to help others. Mm-hmm. In his personal life, he fell apart sometimes and made poor choices and was self-destructive in some ways. And that mix of him, that complexity, allowed him to minister to people in a way that others couldn't, that were more what that society might
define them as more together, more whole, more integrous, more, you know, more perfect. Jordan wasn't perfect. And what it allowed me to do was to relax into, well, it's kind of like the you're not okay and I'm not okay and that's okay frame, that old thing. And it's a wonderful freedom in, you know, one of my prayers is that I would, one of my ways of praying to God now is, dear Lord, help me be a person that others could be safe with, that could feel in my brokenness some way of relating, that we're on the same journey together, and that sometimes I'm crazy, you know, and sometimes I'm not. And somehow that being okay. And I was thinking about what you said today about evil and the nature of evil and things, and I was thinking that one of the best ways to not contribute to evil in our world is to stay in that place of vulnerability where we so can relate to that, to our neighbor, that we don't want to move over to where we're doing them harm, consciously or intentionally doing them harm. I had that thought today I wanted to share with you because my whole thing was I wanted to get to Friday with you because I have to leave Wednesday and I think it was Friday that you were going to talk about how can we not contribute to evil. Mike, am I on the right track here? Before I have to leave on Wednesday. Because it's all kind of related. I mean, it sounds disjointed, but it really isn't. I see a common thread running throughout the room. And that's trying to understand what's okay in the whole loss, grief, healing, growth process. And what, somehow, what can we sanction for each other as a community of believers and say, this is all right, this is okay, and you're safe here in this complex struggle of being human.
I do think in some ways this the container that is the safety, I've heard different versions about the community, whether that's represented in a therapist or a spiritual director or in a friend or in a congregation, that somehow that frames things in a way that allows us to move through it.
That's good. The woundedness of the healer is a very important concept. You know, the wounded healer is sort of a way of thinking about someone who is healing, that they are wounded. And that's an absolutely vital aspect, and it's not just a sort of a containing aspect. It's essential, really, to be able to draw on your own wounds. If you can't actually have your wounds, then it's impossible for you to actually enter into the wounding of the person. So that's vital. And I've been told not to put off answers to questions, so. We're talking about sort of very common thread, I think. It's taking in what is completely antithetical to what we think we are in every sense. Like it's taking in, I think experience with Doug has just been amazing for this community. And taking in something that is completely alien and antithetical in every possible way. And it's a constant challenge. If you're doing that day by day, it's a very, very deep sort of spiritual practice to be doing that. It's pretty much impossible because it's so challenging. But this is what we'll be getting to eventually. This is what Levinas, who I mentioned today a little bit, talks about the face of the other and taking in the face of the other, because the face is always the vulnerable and completely individual aspect of the other person. But sometimes the things come just in symbolic forms too. Like I had a crazy experience in Pioneer Square, coming to work, and I saw a chicken bone, which some homeless person probably had been eating, and just thrown down. And that, because I work in Pioneer Square, my clients come to Pioneer Square, and they have to cross Pioneer Square, and I had all these terrible thoughts, and I just couldn't take in what that chicken bone symbolized about the homeless people and their plight and them throwing their chicken bones down on the sidewalk. So that took me several days to take in that chicken bone. Meaning, but I was actually taking in the people or the persons who were throwing their chicken bones around and lying on the benches and all those sorts of things. Pioneer Square is just a fantastic place in Seattle in that sense. It's constantly challenging you every day that you're there. I actually teach at Harborview Medical Center, that UW has the psychiatry department branch. So I take the bus from Pioneer Square up to Harborview. If you've been on the number 4 bus, that's taking in the number 4 bus. It has every type of person you can possibly imagine on the number 4 bus. And sometimes I can't take the number 4 bus in. But this is what we're sort of generally talking about. I think we're all sort of saying a similar sort of thing. Does that answer the question? I've been dinged for not answering questions.
Well, it's enough for right now.
Thank you.
We have just about maybe 5 more minutes. People can always stay after that, but it's nice to have an ending time. I want to make sure if anyone else has any reaction or comment that you want to enter in here.
I was just thinking that, and maybe it was more implicit than explicit, there's a difference between religion and faith. And sometimes what happens in my own kind of experience with working with people on my own spiritual journey is that religion dies so faith can be born. Mm-hmm. Or religiosity dies. Mm-hmm. You know, a certain persona of how a person feels they need to be as a Christian. Mm-hmm. And then with an experience of the divine or maybe an extraordinary emotional physiological trauma or experience, that sort of falls away. And underneath they discover a new security, maybe a new depth, a new peace, and a new life. But it is shattering. And sometimes religious people get really nervous when someone's going through that, and they talk at them like, well, you're losing the faith. Now, keep the faith. And maybe what they're not losing is the faith. What they're losing is the wrapping.
I did a study for my doctoral program of bereaved parents and asking them questions about how their beliefs, however they termed those beliefs, changed during the grieving process. And almost all of them said they went through a period of real doubts. They struggled with their faith. They struggled with God. Was there a God? And almost all of them came through that time, most without any help. You know, they didn't go to anyone or have anyone who really was supporting them in that. But they came to a place where they were living their beliefs rather than just talking about them. And most of the men said, and I don't know if that's okay for my faith community. When I hear a sermon now, I want a dialogue around it. I want to say, well, this is how it touches me, where before I just went, okay, that's the sermon for today, isn't that nice? And I'll come back next Sunday and hear some more. That they were chewing it, eating it more than they ever were. And so they were saying, I don't think I'm as acceptable now and yet they were living it rather than just talking about it. So I see that as much more psychologically healthy than spiritually healthy.
When you were making your comments about the vulnerability of the therapist, it made me think, and I'll just throw this out as a novel, really, that had a profound effect on me. The book was called The Diary of a Country Priest. Mm. It's by George Bernanos. And in it, the priest, it may be roughly based on the story of a Curé of Ars, who is a saint, who had incredible powers in the confessional. So that people in this novel would come for miles to go to confession, and a number of people see confession and psychotherapy and having lots of complementary ties. But they would come for miles to see him because his words and his presence were so healing, and people could leave the confessional freed of their fear or guilt or shame and able to move on in God's grace. However, in the novel, the priest himself was tortured with anxiety and panic and the inability to live daily life in that same freedom. And there's a poignant line in that novel where the priest is looking at his hands and he says, "Peace, the strange gift of my empty hands." And I guess I'd like to close, particularly as we've been through these few days, with an acknowledgement that we all have opportunities to be that safe container for others, even in our own fragileness and woundedness. And that's probably where we bring ourselves to God's grace to work through us, just as you were saying you would hope you could, so that others can find healing and peace. So with that, anyone is welcome to stay and talk with anyone further, but let's say it's okay to go to bed now if you want to. Or back to the afternoon line. You've got 20 minutes.
Thank you very much. Thank you.